The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
What I'd like to discuss today is the topic of forgiveness. And it is, quite a beautiful topic. It's quite beautiful when people are able to profoundly forgive. And there have been beautiful examples that we periodically come across of people who have been the victims of terrible things who are able to forgive the person who's caused so much harm. And sometimes I'm quite moved, almost to tears, to kind of encounter some of these stories and situations. And until recently, it seemed to have been the domain of religion primarily to really emphasize or discuss the topic of forgiveness. Now, in more recent times, there's Fred Lutzkin at Stanford is doing research on the topic, and it's becoming more prominent, kind of spilling outside of religious worlds, which is a good thing. And and what prompted it to give this topic today is I've been asked to come participate in a small panel, a lunchtime panel at a local high school to talk about forgiveness. And but it's not just forgiveness in general, but the students there have been reading a book called The Sunflower, which is written by a man named Simon Wiesenthal. And Simon Wiesenthal, is that how you pronounce it?
Wiesenthal.
He is a very moving book that he wrote, but half the book is his experience as in Nazi concentration camps as a Jew. And this story, his story, describing the how difficult it was for him to be in there and how from day to day he kind of expected to die. It was very challenging, and people were dying all around him for being killed for all kinds of sometimes extremely petty reasons and for no reason at all, almost. And he was sent on a work work duty to a outside of the camps to a hospital. A German SS hospital, and to kind of help with cleaning and things there. And while he was there, a nurse came over to him and said, "Please come with me." And whenever someone says to these Jewish concentration prisoners, "Come with me," it's not often. You don't ever know what's up. But he went into the hospital with her, and she brought him to the room of a man who was dying. An SS officer who was dying, and left him alone with the officer. And the officer asked him to come, asked Simon to come and sit on his bed, close to him because he couldn't speak. He was all bandaged up, couldn't see his face, and he was dying, maybe the last days of his life. And the SS officer started telling his story of kind of growing up, becoming part of the Hitler Youth Movement, becoming an SS soldier, going off to Poland, fighting the Russians. And Simon couldn't quite understand why this was being explained to him, told him, and he wasn't comfortable being there. And then it comes to the gruesome story of how this officer had been involved with the slaughter of a couple of hundred Jews in some gruesome circumstance. And he was racked with guilt for this, what he had done. And he, before he died, he wanted to be forgiven. And he felt the only people, he had to find a Jew who represented, I guess, the Jewish people, the people who had been killed. If he could maybe make a confession, maybe he could receive his forgiveness for this. Quite a powerful thing. Simon, in response, walks out of the room. Doesn't forgive him, just walks out. And I think the next day, he's sent back to the hospital, I think it's the next day, and finds out the man had died over the night. And this apparently troubled Simon a fair amount, wondering if he did the right thing, what should he have done. And so he talked to people about it, but more significantly, he wrote it up. It's about, I think, about 80, 90 pages story. And then he sent it, his essay, to mostly religious leaders, religious people, ministers and different type people, and to ask them to write what they would have done, what their take on this is. And the book came out, I think, first time in the 1970s, and then it came out again in the early 1990s with some change, some new additions. And Dalai Lama has a piece by that time, and Matthew Ricard is included in it, some Buddhists. And it's very interesting to read different takes. And some people say very adamantly that, of course, you should forgive. It's almost like a duty to forgive. And others say, no, he had no duty, no requirement to forgive. In fact, it doesn't make any sense to forgive. He can't represent the Jewish people. It doesn't make sense for him to do that. So there's a lot of discussion about this, and this is what the high school students are reading. And this is what I've been asked, and I talked to some of these students earlier in the year. They came here, so I guess because they kind of know me, they kind of wanted me to come, as I guess to represent Buddhism, and a panel of other people, right? Some Christians and some Jews going to be there? Yes or no? Oh, you don't know yet. Oh, I said, so I don't know what I'm going to. So that's on Tuesday, and so it's on my mind, and I think the impression I get since the panel, you know, so I probably have like 5 or 10 minutes to say something. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll warm up today. And here I can say more, and then perhaps once I've heard what I have to say, maybe I can figure out how to condense it. And and hopefully it's a significant topic for you. I think it's a significant topic because how do we respond to hurt, to harm being done to us, to others, the harm that we've done to others, what our relationship to all this is a very profound human question. And I think everyone has been hurt. Everyone has caused harm. Some people in smaller kind of ways, some people in catastrophic ways. That, it's amazing. I feel a little bit, uncomfortable around this topic of the book in particular and bringing it up because it's in some ways, I was born 9 years after World War II, but I was born in Europe and I know a lot of people who are deeply affected by World War II. And in most particular, the reason it seems freshest to me and I feel most like, well, who am I to talk about this topic, is my parents-in-law both went through the concentration camps. And my father-in-law, he's still alive, and he was 16 when the camps were opened, and he was released. And so who am I to talk about it? You know, he should talk about it. So I called him up this morning and asked him about this book. He knew about the book. Before I tell you some of the things he said, and then I'll talk a little bit about the Buddhist kind of take on all this, tell you a little bit his story. He is a Dutch Jew. And I found out today, I didn't know, that early in the war, after the Germans took over Holland, his father was arrested for a relatively small thing. But the small thing was the Germans wanted him to do something, and he said, no, that doesn't make any sense. And it was just a conversation, so that was 6 weeks in jail. And without any knowledge whether he'd ever be released. And his best friend was also taken into prison at the same time and never came out. Died there. But he was released early on. But at some point, they were all arrested, him and his parents. He was the only child. And they were sent to a camp. And they were a little unusual in that they were on a list of special people, special Jews, who could be used for exchange for German prisoners of war, if that ever came up as an issue. So they were given slightly preferential treatment. I mean, slight was, you know, they weren't killed. And at some point, this is what a story I just learned recently, is that his parents showed up on a list of people who were going to be exchanged. And so they were going to get passage to Palestine. But the son was not on the list. My father-in-law was not on the list. And the parents refused to go. And so my father-in-law, as a 16-year-old, went to the officers and argued that this was a mistake and that he should be allowed to go too. And they didn't listen to him. And his parents then died. And he survived. It's quite something, huh? And for 50 years or so, until recently, about last year, he carried with him in his mind the idea, if only I'd argued better. If only I had, you know. And then, luckily for him, someone wrote a story, a book, about that particular group of Jews going to that particular camp. So he's not, you know. And from that book, he read this last year, he said, he realized, I couldn't have argued. It wouldn't make any difference what I said. And that freedom from that idea that I could have done something. And my mother-in-law, she was in the same camp. They kind of knew each other before the war and also a little bit in the camps, in the same camp. And there's a lot of people that in their circle who went through the camps and they still connected to each other. Very fresh. And there's something about that particular incident, that particular times that should never be forgotten. I feel it's important to bring up. But what do we do about it? I know, is so who am I to talk about forgiveness around this? So I asked my father-in-law, and he said some interesting things today. He said he didn't think it made so much sense to forgive. He thought that forgiveness it was kind of a Christian thing, and it was very important for Christians for a variety of reasons, partly because of the relationship to a forgiving God. But he felt it was very important to find peace of mind. And he felt, and so how do you find that? How does the victim find peace with something like that? And some of the same things that have to happen for forgiveness have to happen to find some peace. Kind of because a lot of some of the reason why forgiveness is necessary for the people who've been harmed, is that if anger or resentment is being held, then it hurts. It's, you know, continues the pain to hold on or continue with the resentment or the hurt, the anger. So what releases the anger? What releases the resentment? And for some people, the movement of forgiveness is what allows that to happen. But maybe there's other ways of releasing anger and resentment besides forgiveness. He also said that, you know, for Simon, in the situation of the war and to the prisoner, it didn't make any sense to forgive while you're still being the victim. You know, it's one thing to forgive after you're no longer being, you know, in danger. So, you know, how do you find peace was a very important issue for him. And the second was a kind of a mixed thing, he said, about blame. He said a number of, kind of complicated what he said, and I don't know if I can represent him. But partly he said, you want to let go of blaming people. So perhaps letting go of resentment and not blaming someone is very closely akin to forgiveness. But he also, at the same time, you don't want to pardon people of the responsibility of what they've done as well. And so, and he's a little bit sensitive, I think, for him, because after the war, he found there were a lot of people in Holland, a lot of Dutch people, who, you know, non-Jews, who said, you know, we were innocent. We didn't know we were innocent, we were innocent. And then it took years and decades for it slowly to come out that people weren't so innocent. And in fact, what he said today is that 50% of the Jews who were hiding in Holland during World War II were turned into the Nazis by the Dutch. And often for very simple, you know, for just a little bit of money, for reward, or because they were afraid, their jobs were at stake, their lives were at stake, something. So how innocent were they? He also recognized very much how difficult the time was and how people, everyone was scared and everyone was, you know, trying to cope with often saving their own lives. And so have some greater understanding of the scope than what really happened there, I think makes it easier for him not then to assign blame or not hold blame for someone without at the same time abdicating them a responsibility. So what is it like to not have anger towards someone who has hurt you? What does it take? And what does it take not to limit them or by holding them in a position of blame from you? And this gets closer, I think, to a Buddhist approach to forgiveness. Forgiveness is not a big thing in Buddhism. You find some discussion of forgiveness or words that seem to be like forgiveness in Buddhism. One of the words in Theravadan Buddhism that is sometimes translated as forgiveness is the word abhaya, which means to be fearless. Or another way of understanding it is to offer fearlessness to someone else. They have nothing to fear from you. So if someone has harmed you, what you offer back is they have nothing to fear from you. So that's sometimes taken as forgiveness. And the other is a word called kamma, K-H-A-M-A, which apparently is one of the words that's also used for the to mean earth, the earth. And it has more the meaning of, as far as I can tell, of equanimously accepting someone's confession. Because in Buddhism, confessing what we've done is very important. To stay honestly, this is what happened, this is what I've done, and I disavow myself from this activity. To that kind of recognition, that kind of self-recognition of what we've done and naming it is a very important part of Buddhist spirituality. So if you've done some major transgression, we want to be very important to find someone to talk to and say, this is what I've done, and I know I disavow myself, I separate myself from this. And then the role of the person who hears that statement of truth is to acknowledge it, to recognize, yes, I hear it, and I hear that you are disavowing yourself from that. It's not the same thing as forgiving, but it's a very clear, kind of important interpersonal kind of movement there where someone hears it and acknowledges it. And that acknowledgement is maybe because it's kind of this open, accepting, kind of grounded equanimity. It's the same word is used as the word for earth, like the earth receives everything. So forgiveness is not a really big thing in Buddhism. And I would argue that the reasons for that is that it's a very different worldview, that it comes out of than the worldview of Christianity. And I don't know much about Christianity, and I put my foot in my mouth a few weeks ago here around this. So I'm going to be careful what I say, but my impression is that God is really important in Christianity. And so, and in some Christians, the judgments of God are very consequential. Because if God judges you one way, you go to heaven. If he judges you another way, you go to hell. And that's a kind of a consequential distinction. And it lasts a while, you know. And so there's a lot at stake. And so, being forgiven by God is a very, very important thing. To be pardoned, to be absolved of guilt in such a way that the eternal consequence of this is no longer there. So I believe kind of in the background of certain kind of especially Christian currents of Western culture, forgiveness has this very big meaning, very big importance. And so people talk a lot about how important it is for us to forgive, probably because it resonates or kind of reflects back to this kind of theistic idea of forgiveness. So Buddhism comes from a very different worldview. Buddhism doesn't start with a god. In the beginning of the Bible, it says, you know, God made the earth. In the beginning of the Buddhist Bible, there's no beginning. There's no Bible in the same way, but in the beginning of Buddhist scriptures, it says the mind, everything begins with the mind. It begins with us. There is no God who's the creator and the arbitrator for Buddhists. What there is your own conscience. And one of the ways of talking about that is talking about karma. And no one can absolve you of your karma. So you have to live that out and take responsibility for yourself. So Buddhist, it doesn't make, you know, there is no other, no God, no priest, no victim who can absolve you of the karmic consequences of what you've done. You can change the karmic consequences by how you deal with it. So if you go and confess, for example, and apologize, that changes the karmic currents. So you have a role, a very important role in it, but your karma is not going to be changed much or at all by someone else saying, "I forgive you." Or if you say, "I forgive you," to someone, that might be helpful for them, but it doesn't really free them from their own responsibility, their own karmic, the way their own conscience, their own mind has to process it and deal with it. we don't free someone from their guilt by offering them forgiveness. We free them from our need for retribution. We free them from our anger and resentment. We free them from the ways in which we might close our heart to them. But they still have to somehow cope and deal with what they've done. And how do we do that in a mature way? So the movement in Buddhism is to... that kind of worldview, there's a very different approach to what to do with these kinds of interpersonal problems and harms that have been caused. So in Buddhism, the direction tends to be a little bit more personal. So if you've been harmed and you're holding anger and resentment, if you don't have any peace of mind, then it's your job to figure out how to free yourself of that holding, the clinging to that anger or that resentment. And that's a powerful process, a very deep process. So sometimes, depending on what happens, takes a lot of work, a lot of self-reflection, a lot of wisdom. But the tendency in Buddhism is to turn towards yourself rather than turn and assign the blame. To turn towards yourself and see, what can I do to make a difference so I can find peace of mind with this? What am I holding on to? What am I, you know, afraid of? And to really do some, you know, very deep inner work to free ourselves from how we're caught by whatever happened. And it's very hard. It's a very delicate thing, I think, sensitive thing, to say this to someone who's been deeply harmed. To say, you know, you should turn around and look at what you're holding on to here. Because it almost like puts salt in the wound. To ask someone to forgive is a very honorable thing, I think. Because when you forgive someone, it kind of puts you in a little bit superior role, like you're an honored role, you know. And say, rather than being the one who has to kind of go look at your stuff, it's more like you can offer something, and it puts you in a better position. So for someone who's been hurt, it's easier sometimes the movement of forgiveness. However, it also does put you in a little bit superior role, and Buddhism doesn't like that. Buddhism likes it not to have this sense of superiority or inferiority in relationship with each other, but to meet each other much more as equals. And so there's a lot of talk in Buddhism, for example, that compassion should never be hierarchical. It shouldn't be that you're higher than someone looking down, feeling sorry for them. It should really be equals with this empathy and a shared understanding of the shared kind of life that we live. So this delicacy around forgiveness, you know, the status thing, and you know, there's a lot goes on there. So the tendency in Buddhism is not to focus so much on forgiveness, as a concept is understood in Christianity. But if we divide up different elements of forgiveness, in Buddhism the focuses would be on doing your own work to free yourself of anger, resentment, clinging. And then a second thing. And that is, a second thing is to find goodwill in your heart. To find some kind of goodwill or loving kindness for others. So rather than lumping those things all into one package called forgiveness, Buddhism separates them out into two different things. There's a work of freeing yourself from your clinging, and then there's finding in your heart to be open-hearted enough to have kind thoughts or kind wishes or for the person, for anybody, for everybody. And the Buddha emphasized a lot that you should have goodwill, have an open, loving heart, caring heart, even for your enemies. And that's not easy. And so, as a powerful world religion, Buddhism is not only here to make you feel comfortable and nice, but also to challenge you really deeply. And this is one of the places of challenge, is can you find not only forgiveness or letting go, can you let go of your anger, resentment towards people who are your enemies, but can you also find in your heart goodwill and kindness towards them as well? So as the Dalai Lama says, my friends, or you say, how do you say it, my friends the enemy? My friends, sometimes he uses the word friend and enemy together in the same sentence, referring to the Chinese.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's different. That's very different. It's also good. Everybody should be your friend, including. And so what does that take? And you know, one of the very dramatic places where the Buddha says this in the ancient scriptures, he says, he's talking to his monastics, monks and nuns. So there's expectation that they have a much higher sense of purpose for their life than maybe anybody else. So there's a higher standard of what's needed for their inner cultivation. And to his monastic, he says, even if someone, robbers, were sawing off your arms, if you get angry at them, you're not doing my instructions. You should cultivate loving kindness for the person who is cutting off your arms. So that's pretty dramatic. You can't get more dramatic than that, hardly. Now, is this kind of religious hyperbole that you kind of just can make a point? Or is it really meant that way? And we find this, some of you have heard these stories of Dalai Lama tells them. He was very moved, apparently, when there was a Tibetan monk who was released, he knew in Tibet in 1959, who was imprisoned for a long time in Tibet, finally was able, released from prison and escaped to India. And Dalai Lama asked his old friend, he said, were you ever in danger when you were in prison? I think he meant, you know, for your life, perhaps. And the monk said, oh yes, I was in danger. I had the danger of losing my compassion for the Chinese. There's prison guards. So tendency in Buddhism is not to focus so much on forgiveness, but to focus on these two other things that could look like forgiveness as a pack, if you put them together as a package, is to release the resentment and not be someone who's dangerous for other people, and then to find the place of goodwill for somebody else. And so we go back and look at Simon Wiesenthal and this SS officer in that room. I think from a Buddhist point of view, there was no requirement or even appropriateness to forgive the SS officer. But from a Buddhist point of view, it's also a pity or unfortunate that he walked out. Because the SS officer is a human being, as anybody else is. And even if he couldn't forgive him, could he do something else for him? Were there other options there? And what might have been some of the options of how to support and help? One might be to acknowledge the confession. I hear you. Another might be to encourage the SS officer to turn his heart around and not just ask for forgiveness, but to generate goodwill to the Jews. And this is a very important part in Buddhism, is to actually turn around and generate it. Because it's not automatic that someone who confesses a crime has goodwill for the people, for the victims. There's still all kinds of things going on there. And for the well-being of the officer, from the Buddhist point of view, the well-being of the officer is the idea to turn the heart around that dramatically and actually feel goodwill is one of the healthiest things that can be done in the times before dying. And so perhaps there could have been some help, support for the officer to do that. So to phrase the discussion as should he or should not he have forgiven is too limited in the discussion. But, you know, to ask someone who's a concentration camp victim to do that, you know, this is someone who's starving, saw death every day around him, felt at any moment now he could be killed. You know, you can't expect. You know, I don't know, if I was in that circumstance, maybe I would have walked out. Or maybe I just would have had a heart attack. just too much for my heart to handle, just to something like that, such a difficult situation. So, it's a powerful story, it's a powerful topic, and I say it here today partly because when we sit down to be mindful, to be aware of our breath, our body, our feelings, our thoughts, it's not a lightweight thing to do. We're sitting down in the midst of this life where these things occur, these things happen, finding our way in it. And it's certainly my belief, my faith, my understanding that to sit down in the middle of it and be present is to be honest and available and to work with and bring forth the best in each of us in these kinds of circumstances. And I think the world really needs it. So forgiveness, I think, is a really beautiful movement that people who can do it, for whatever reason, is powerful, beautiful. And for those of you who are more kind of aligned with the Buddhist worldview, perhaps your forgiveness will look like releasing your holding and generating goodwill. So we have a few minutes. Now I saw a hand. Do you want to ask now?
It seems to me what you're saying, but not quite saying, is forgiveness is a gift to ourselves.
I think that, yes, it is a gift to ourselves. And one of the reasons to do forgiveness is for our own sake, not for the sake of the other, just because it's continuing the harm not to do that. But if forgiveness is pardoning the other person or absolving them of their guilt, that's a delicate thing. So some people kind of are confused about that. And
it has nothing to do with anybody else.
So sometimes forgiveness is very private. It can be done. The other person never needs to know. Sometimes they can. It can make a big difference. Yes, so over here.
So these were very interesting stories. Put me in mind of that famous philosopher Lily Tomlin, who said that forgiveness is giving up all hope for having a different past. Seems to me that Seaman Wiesenthal did something that's very important. He witnessed. He sat in a neutral place and listened. Hard enough to do under the circumstances. And then he continued to search his own mind in the years after. I'm just not sure there was anything more I would have asked of him to do.
No, I think it's beautiful. I think so. I'm reminded also that, like in South Africa, they have the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's not the Truth and Forgiveness Commission. Maybe forgiveness was not possible, but reconciliation is.
I think the thing that I struggle with is that tension between knowing that to forgive will be beneficial to me, but also feeling like if I do forgive, I'm betraying something inside of me or overriding it or trampling on it or saying it's not important, it's not that important.
Yes, I think that there's many associations people have with forgiveness, or many ways, many things people think they're doing when they're forgiving. They can make it complicated. So one of them might be, for example, forgiving someone is to pardon them. Or forgiving means it was not important. You know, well, it didn't really count. It's okay. It's kind of dismissing it, or it's sometimes even some kind of condoning it, I don't think that works very well. It's possible to forgive someone of what they've done, and still expect them to go to jail. In fact, you know, you did this terrible thing. I forgive you. My heart is open to you. I wish you the best. I'm not going to hold it against you, but you know, you got to go to jail. That's the kind of worldly consequence that I'm not going to free you from.
Last March, their CIIS put on a seminar, Buddhism for Difficult Times or something like that. It was very good. A question like this came up, and the question was raised that we are all, what to do when the abuse is still ongoing, and are we not all still involved in those abusive relationships? They framed it much as you did, releasing the anger, something like that, I don't remember exactly. But then the question arose, aren't we all involved with difficult work relationships, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, it's ongoing. What to do?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a different things are required if it's over versus if it's ongoing, and different strategies, different approaches, different issues going on, and certain things don't make sense to do until it's stopped. If the violence, the abuse is still going on, the first thing to do is to get it to stop. Yes.
The question I have, and I apologize for kind of stumbling through it, is when you give the story and then you sort of ask the question, or the question is sort of implied, I guess, well, what would a Buddhist do, or what would we do based on our understanding? And then it sort of seems that there's this writings or whatever it is, and there's this sort of hierarchy, and you try to kind of go up the hierarchy to find out the principle that first applies or something. And I'm a little bit confused as to why the question isn't so much whether or not there should be a principle in Buddhism that applies to all possible things, as opposed to just saying, you must really think for yourself very deeply about what is actually happening in a manner that seems less prejudicial based on emotionally driven responses, which might be true, but which may, as a consequence, force you to make later on when you look back at it a wrong decision. So to me, sort of example, the story seems to be more of, here this person has had all these wrong things to him, but when he sees this specific individual there, then these sort of prejudicial stereotypes about the whole situation is, it's clear to him that that's forcing him to think differently about it. What he should do, I don't know. But just simply the challenge of forcing you to think differently and try to get to some place that you can deal with is really what is being implied, as opposed to trying to find some abstract principle that says, in this circumstance, this is what you should do.
That's reason. I think that's reasonable. So then, the distinction you're making is looking towards some religion like Buddhism for its principles to guide you in how you're going to live your life, versus using your own thinking and good sense to kind of sort through what's going on in your life and free yourself from your prejudice on your own. You don't need anybody else, any religious worldview, to help you do that, or any ideas of what you're supposed to do, right? Is that the difference you're making?
With the caveat that you must always be aware that you may not be thinking clearly, or you may be driven by other events. In other words, try to become as objective to what's actually happening with your thoughts as possible before making a decision.
Yes. And it's very hard to do that. So one of the reasons to study religions, philosophy, other approaches, worldviews, so we can get properly challenged. And people tend to think that their worldview, how their way of thinking, is kind of like that's how things are. And so for Buddhists, they have a deeply ingrained, traditional Buddhists, grew up Buddhists, deeply ingrained worldview which they're operating under. And someone who's Christian or Jewish or Muslim has a whole other worldview they're ingrained in. And it's very interesting to have interfaith dialogue, because sometimes you see yourself in a deeper way. You see, oh, that's what's going on for me. Now I understand. I couldn't have seen it unless I had some other. And so I think this whole topic of forgiveness is interesting, because everyone has to grapple with forgiveness. But what is it? And there's some confusion. It's a very vague topic. People think they're all talking about the same thing. Forgiveness is good, and we should all do it. But actually, forgiveness is many different things. Movements of the heart or movements of the mind are fit under the category called forgiveness. And people think they're talking about the same thing, but they're not. And so by teasing it apart, by this religion is like this, this worldview is like this, you start seeing, oh, it's more complicated. And my hope with Buddhism, that Buddhism is a challenging religion, that it's useful to study its principles and all that, not so we become Buddhists, but so that it's one of the tools to free us from the prejudice, from the worldviews, from the ways we get stuck, from the limitations we have. That's my hope, that Buddhism's like a crowbar.
For me, when I think about forgiveness, I think about spaciousness, because it's that space in which we have if we can use our mindfulness to have a reaction to what's happened. I don't know if Megan is here yet, but she works with kids in the schools, and she was telling me an amazing story last week of working with children to provide mindfulness instruction, and then as gang tensions develop in the schools, one kid told her a story recently about having the spaciousness to decide whether to use a gun that was in his pocket or not when he was upset and not forgiving of something happened.
Had a good result.
And it was an amazing... So for me, I've really seen in our practice, or for myself, that when I can give myself those couple of seconds... Not always, of course. But I had a son who was kidnapped when he was 18, and he knew the boy who kidnapped him. And the story was, and we don't know for sure, that he was being inducted into a gang in Berkeley, and one of the things he needed to do was to harm someone. And he told my son he was going to kill him. My son broke out of the trunk of the car, and it was really amazing to me to find as a mom that what I really needed to do was make sure that that kid was put in a safe jail. It was just a reaction. My son was very upset with me that we didn't make sure the kid went to San Quentin, which was an option, but to a California Youth Authority, which didn't become one. He had to go to a county jail where he was safer. But I feel it was really an outcome of this practice, where we want for others what we feel for ourselves, and our metta and our ability to step back a little bit and really try and feel out the situation. So I'm really grateful for the topic and for our practice that informs it.
Yeah, so that's a good way to end. So we're not really, at the heart of what hopefully we're about here is not philosophy or worldviews, but rather our practices that support us to do this deep inner inquiry that allows us to you know, see what's really going on and what's possible. And I have a lot of faith in the human heart that is mindful, that's aware, that's attentive, and really pays careful attention to what goes on. We have beautiful hearts, and it's beautiful, beautiful hearts. Given half a chance, those hearts will do a lot of good in the world. And I hope that the awareness practice that we do allows your goodness to come forth and offer support to everyone. May all beings be happy. Thank you.